The Forever GM never stops thinking about how to make games better. If you are one, want to be one, or would like to find one, you're in the right place. Welcome to the Forever GMs podcast, the roundtable where two professional game masters dig into the craft of running games for a living alongside other professionals in the RPG industry. I'm Liv.
And I'm Doc. And today we have a fantastic couple of guests. We have Chris Sneezak, our audio editor and my friend and game designer and podcaster and many, many hats. And of course, Teos Abadia, game designer, podcaster, the Mastering Dungeons podcast, which is a fantastic resource.
Great show.
And a fan of organized play. How are you guys doing?
Nice to be here. Thank you.
I'm good. I'm glad to be here. Glad to be on this end of the microphone for once.
Yeah, that's
true. And hi, Chris.
What's up, Teos? How's it going?
There is an extra pressure today knowing that I'm saying things to you that you're going to have to go back and be like, I can't believe she did that.
I know it's definitely there. But before we get into our topic, I would like to talk a little bit about our game spotlight. And our game spotlight is a game, maybe the number one game I want to play. Haven't had a chance to. Been looking forward to it, but Lancer, it's built almost entirely around encounters. It is a tactical mech RPG by Massive Pressed. Players pilot customizable mechs into highly intense combat scenarios. If you've seen any sort of mech anime, that's what they're trying to emulate. It is built into two elements, narrative play and tactical combat. It's about the story of understanding what it takes to be someone that pilots these things, whilst also having the tactical and table element of fighting in these giant robot tanks. And it's built to just really emulate that. I'm excited to talk about this game. Has anybody played Lancer here?
I've been part of the Lancer Discord for about 3 months, and I've been trying to get into a one-shot. And you know what? Never time. Never time. On my schedule or on theirs to fit in. So I've been trying for a while.
Tish, you didn't play this? I thought I remember you talking about it. Maybe it was a different podcast.
Yeah, I have wanted to, but I haven't. I have spoken with Tom Bloom because he's also a Crack the Sun, Draw Steel fan. And so we did chat with him, but he was too busy to help us on that project. But Tom's really fantastic, very creative. And I love the sort of fourth edition background, which is something that Draw Steel has in common as being inspiration for what it is as a game.
I've read through this game. I actually didn't want to play it after I read through it. And there's no shit on it. The game is fine. Like, I loved fourth edition. It plays just like that. I just wasn't looking for that at the time. I was looking for more Gundam Wing, which is way more story-based than like getting a mech and beat on each other. But if you like, I can't remember the name of it. I think the people, Break... It's a video game. It's like an 8-bit video. It's like a 16-bit video game that I think the people that made Faster Than Light made it. It's a really, really great game. It plays like that, and it's pretty fantastic.
I used to play that game all the time, and I can't think of it, too.
Yeah, me neither.
I used to play the arcade version of it.
About to go open my Steam Deck and...
We'll put it in the notes.
This was a little bit of an excuse for me to talk a little bit about that story and tactical element, and 4th edition kind of ties into that a little bit, which... I didn't play much 4th edition at all, but I ended up playing the 4th edition version of Gamma World a bunch. And weirdly, like, that game was so strange, and then suddenly you had this weird tactical thing. And I found that more compelling. Like, here's this weird, weird game, and then suddenly you've got, like, these tactical rules on the battlefield that you're paying attention to all these different other elements, and it's very specific and everything. And I always liked the idea of those were so separate in like the approach to those. Like Lancer feels like that to me. The story feels like this, like epic, like, oh my, can I do it? You know? And then all of a sudden you're on the battlefield and it's like, nope, you this rule. I don't know.
I have not. It's, you know, so many games I want to play, but I know that folks in my Discord sing its praises. Those who have tried it have said it's really a lot of fun, super exciting, and has made them sort of rethink what they thought about 4th edition because they played Lancer and liked it so much, even for folks who didn't like 4th edition, which I liked a lot.
It made me rethink 4th edition. That's the other thing I'll say about it. So.
Yeah.
Our game spotlight.
Definitely sounds like something we need to try, either on Patreon or somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, listen, if you want to see us play Lancer, let's do some Patreon
in the
stuff.
Comments. Yeah.
Yeah.
Doc, you kind of alluded to it at this point in time, but based on our game spotlight, today we are talking about building encounters, which I'm sure for a lot of audience, they know combat encounters, you know, hack and slash, beat the dragon, hordes of goblins, and you're coming up with strategies together. But I want to open this up to our two guest panelists today. How do you think about encounters beyond just combat in TTRPGs, such as puzzles, traps, or even social challenges?
Well, Chris, I've had the benefit of playing at your table a couple times and seen even things that you created that I played through. So why don't you start with how do you approach it? I'm curious to hear what you say.
Oh, man. Outside of fighting stuff, I always think of the fight as being ancillary these days to what's actually going on. If the story isn't inside the fight or the fight isn't pivotal, then it's not that big of a deal to me. It's fun, don't get me wrong. I'm not playing a lot of combat-oriented games right now. To put that forward, right now I am running Delta Green. I just got done running Call of Cthulhu. I'm public access. I ran a campaign of that, right? So we're talking about a lot of games that are investigative heavy. So when it comes to social interactions, which those happen a lot in there, for me it's about identifying what the NPC actually wants out of the situation, what the point of the scene potentially could be, like knowing what the players are trying to get out of it themselves, and then playing those two things off of each other, utilizing the things that you would normally utilize, like what resources can I make them spend? What choices do they actually have to make here? Because to me, while it's a storytelling engine, these games are storytelling engines, they're still games. So I'm always looking for the game, the choice that exists inside there. That is specifically for the social stuff. Clue things depends on the game, but normally you want to give people clues because otherwise you can't move on with the thing that's happening. So when you play a game like Public Access or any of the Car from Brindlewood games, it's already built in. Like if you don't roll well enough, there's going to be a complication for your action. And that's how a lot of that stuff works. You play, I try to set it up that way, like understanding what the context is of the situation so I can come up with reasonable complications that make sense in the narrative so everybody is satisfied with what's going on moving forward. And hopefully sometimes those complications tie back into what the characters care about and matter to them.
Yeah, I'll echo that. I start with what is the point of this? You know, where are we in the story? What are we doing? Why am I placing this encounter here to begin with, right? And it's not because I want four goblins in a room. It's because there's something that's going on in the arc of this experience. And so this room, this scene, whatever it is, this outdoor environment, whatever this masquerade ball, whatever it is that happens in this location, it must facilitate that experience, right? And create that arc. And the arc isn't just mine, it's of the players as well. So it hopefully brings things in and is evocative and engaging so the players will want to add to it. But once I think through what its place is, right? So if like this is a dungeon that we're exploring, and this is the room that's going to tell you that there is another faction inside of the dungeon, right? Then that's the important thing. And so while it may be a combat or it may be social or whatever it is that I'm creating as a gameplay type thing, that overriding arc is the important part. And that's what really needs to come out. And then I'll drop in those elements. And I think of it a lot like a cinematographer must think, a director or a writer of a script, where you're thinking, okay, this is what this needs to tell at this point in time, but I still need to sell tickets, right? And the same way, you still want to have fun with the combat. And so that's where, you know, that the monsters are exciting or that the NPC is charming and interesting or you love to hate them, whatever it is, that needs to happen too. But once you've already set that outer, you know, framework for it.
When I build encounters, and these days I'm building a lot of encounters for Dungeons and Dragons, and I think one of the things that I often look at just along exactly what you said is what's the goal of this encounter existing at all? And because there are plenty of times where I'll say like, oh, you run into this. You're tough. You're this level. You take him out, which isn't always I don't always do that. If I want to have a big encounter where they feel big and tough, that's great. But I think sometimes I really focus on, what's this going to make the players feel like? How is this going to feel? Are they going to feel overwhelmed and beaten? Are they going to feel Are they going to feel big and tough beating up a bunch of little things? I also try to anticipate those times where a combat encounter will turn into a social encounter and vice versa. Since I run for kids a lot, those times are many.
Yeah, I want to echo what everyone has said. There has to be a purpose to an encounter, whether it's combat, whether it is social, whether it's a puzzle. I know often when I have an encounter that feels like it has not run effectively or well for the group, it's because it doesn't have purpose. So sometimes I'll put a puzzle in a room for kids and they'll be like, why must I do this? And it's kind of just like, we haven't done a puzzle in a while, so I put a puzzle there, yeah. Right? And no one enjoys it.
Yeah,
I've done that quite a bit. But when it actually ties into the story and they're actually learning more about the world, the NPCs around them, the conflict, then those things go really, really well.
Yeah,
I also run a lot of Dungeons and Dragons for kids, too. So I don't do a lot of combat encounters. And if I do, it's meant to be like really cool, big bad, you slay it. We finish this in like 30 minutes or less, you know. Mm-hmm. And so thinking about your audience, your players in that as well, and taking their perspective is really important.
Absolutely. Anything else on that topic?
Puzzles are for me, a ton of fun.
Yeah.
In part because it's a different way to express what's going on. And I often, you know, sometimes I'll use what people really think of puzzles, where it's like a riddle, mm-hmm. or it's, you know, five bins and you got to pick a thing out of it and put the right ones.
Yeah.
Those can be fun at times too. But mostly what I'll do is just something where it's, you've got to figure out what the problem is here.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there is a river flowing through the room and you've got to, you know, pour sand in this mechanism to stop it from flowing or something like that, right? Divert its course or something. And when that has to do with the larger environment and the larger plot, then that's really cool, right? So for example, if it's a Dark Sun adventure and there's a dry riverbed, and you know water is precious, so it's an opportunity to underscore that with something that has to do with water.
Mm-hmm.
And if this is an ancient temple that long ago used to have running water, that's something everybody can react to. And so this puzzle has enough interest to it that hopefully you're buying not just the player's interest, but their characters. So even if they're not super, they don't love puzzles, they want to figure out what happened with this ancient dry riverbed. And maybe it's just going to be an illusion of water flowing through, but that momentary thing will be a payoff that they'll work off of in character as well. And so something like that can be a lot of fun.
That ties a little bit into another thought I had. It's always great when a puzzle feels like it's naturally part of the environment and not somebody mm-hmm. put in place. With that water one, that's a great one. That temple might have had water going through it that would open mechanisms and systems and stuff like that. And that water doesn't exist anymore. So how do you go about accessing those things when there's no water to be had?
Yeah, making it feel like it matters, right? It's not mm-hmm. just you solved the riddle, the door opens, but there's something interesting there. And a real simple one I like is a talking door, where you just see this big face on a door. The door looks really strong and reinforced and whatever. And you walk up to it and it goes, I'm not sure I should let you in.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've just got to convince it to open, right? And that can just be fun interplay because someone in the party will step up and say, all right, I'm going to talk to this door. And you know, maybe it wants a secret. Maybe it wants, you know, a story. Who knows what it wants? And maybe you can try to just run through its mouth when the mouth is open, but it might try to bite you. Just, something like that can be really fun. Doors are one of my favorites to do a sort of puzzle talking element like that.
I don't know that I've ever had a talking door.
You should try it sometime. It's a good time.
Yeah.
Puzzles are always so weird to me. There's nothing wrong with them. I think they're great. And I do like to slide them into games, but it's the idea of the players and the character should be able to figure this out. So I have to make sure that I have some way that the players can use their character sheets and the things that are a part of their character to help solve these puzzles, whatever that fictional positioning that they might have is. So that's a thing that I always think about when I'm designing or putting together things or running them, especially when I'm running them, like what is the fictional positioning that these characters actually have to like solve this stuff? And does their intelligence or wisdom scores or whatever those stats might be in the game that you're playing affect that? I am also a huge fan of making the puzzle part of the world at large. So it's not just like a random thing, to the point where we were playing Rapscallion. It's a Powered by the Apocalypse game. We're still actually playing it, but I'm not going to explain too much. It's a long story, but they were down in this space And I actually built out an escape room in my house that mimicked the dungeon part that they were in. So they actually had to physically get up and play the escape room part of the game in my house. And I had a timer on my phone and everything. And they could use their character sheets. There was a custom move that I built where if they needed a clue, they could use some of the stats to make a roll and it would take time off the timer to get a clue.
Oh, nice.
See, that's...
that's so cool.
That's why you ask someone like that to talk about encounters.
Now,
that's great, Chris. That's really good.
Yeah, I ain't gonna lie. Like, I studied escape room. I mean, I've done like 50 escape rooms at this point in my life, but I also went and like studied like puzzle design for like 20 hours. I put like 20 hours of study in to figure that out for what was essentially like 45 minutes of play. And I don't think, I mean, I have to do it again to make it worth my time for what I did, but I'm glad I did it. I learned some stuff, but it was a lot of work.
It, you know, you learn a new skill to run a game and you just have to do it twice and then you're fine. Right?
Then never again. Don't ever touch it again.
So legitimately in this room that I'm sitting in right now, there is a like a secret hidden panel under the carpet over there that I can actually pull the carpet up and open a panel and put stuff inside of it. So I'll use that at some point.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Love it.
How much do we all rely on encounter building guidelines, challenge rating in Dungeons and Dragons, for example, versus instincts and experience?
I'll say because I am often writing things that see publication, it behooves me to be up on all of the things. And so I have my own spreadsheet that uses all of the rules for any game that I might write for. And I follow it religiously, way more than most people will do. And so, you know, like with 2014 5e, I would use the multiplier, right? Even with people, oh, don't use that. Well, those are the guidelines. So I want to really know them. I don't want to understand them when I'm, you know, creating for Draw Steel. Well, I have a spreadsheet that does that too. And so I'm always following it very carefully because I want to really understand those rules and how they work. Now, once the encounter starts, I may adjust in a number of ways, but I want to build it following all the rules so I absolutely know them. And so to me, like, I almost can't imagine the DMs out there that just, you know, pick a monster and toss it in, which I totally understand and okay with, but it's just, I never do that because I'm almost always planning things. Outside of a system like, I ran a Savage Worlds campaign, and there is no system to it, right? It's just some monsters are harder, some monsters are weaker. They don't tell you what to do at all. And so you just throw something in there and then you have to adjust on the fly. So I guess that's the one case where I don't.
I am actually the opposite, Theos. I am kind of, because I work a lot with kids, right? And so we have certain time constraints to our encounters. We might get delayed doing our puzzle and then I only have 20 minutes left of session. And so I have to look at my combat encounter and say, okay, I have half the time I thought I was going to have on this now. Let me throw in some monsters, take out some monsters, add in a special ability to make it go faster. A lot of the stuff that I do is a lot more narrative and storytelling. And because of that, sometimes I don't rely so much on those official guides. And that's also just the nature of a table sort of thing. So I have players when I play in community games who want me to be very like by the book, and I can be very by the book for them and follow those official guides. With kids, almost never. I have a group of Chaos Goblins right now. I don't know if we've played actual Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition in like over a year. We currently have Sukuna from Jujutsu Kaisen in our campaign.
Wow, that's
There's
cool.
no stat block for him. We're just we're running wild. So some of those things, it really varies on the players you have and the type of game that you are creating, experience you're creating for them.
I like using the stuff to begin with. I'm a big fan of when I'm learning the game and learning how it works, I will use the guidelines because I need to see what the guidelines are. But as anybody knows, I mean, Tails is right. I mean, if you're writing for publication, you have no idea what the table is going to be. But when you're game mastering at home, you know who your players are. You know kind of what they can do. So good place to start. But eventually you need to customize that stuff for the people that you're playing with because they're not going to. Man, so I added the Gnomecast and I added Thaco with Advantage. If anybody who listens to those shows, Ange Murray is on there and she's like, some of her games, her players are not very good at playing the game, but some of the games, those players are really good at playing the game. And she uses the same kind of building for both those groups. One group's going to wipe the floor with them. One group's not going to bother. I mean, you've heard those stories about players that just destroy CR 25 encounters with like level 12 characters, right? Like it happens. So, you know, you tailor it to the people that you're playing with.
So when I was learning to run games, I was using the White Wolf games, the World of Darkness stuff, and GURPS. And so it was all Wild West then. I had no idea whether a group would survive or not most of the time. And third edition was kind of a delight because it was like, here's, you know, this the CR means that at this level, you know, a capable group should be able to handle this. I didn't really realize there was a curve built into the CR until quite a bit later. But I do enjoy using the CR to guide me almost as a quick reference. I also will admit that if I say I want you guys to fight a dragon, but you're fifth level, I'm gonna describe a dragon, but I'm gonna find a fifth level a five CR thing that you're actually fighting and use those stats. So,
yeah, I think that's where it really gets into tailoring it for your players. And we've talked about like combat and challenge ratings, but what about for those non-combat encounters? So I'm thinking like those roleplay encounters where someone has to roll to persuade someone or to deceive. Like, what official guidelines are you using for those, if any?
There's not a lot of like official like D&D stuff for that, really, is there? Or if there is, maybe I'm not aware of it. Hey,
just the skill difficulty chart, you know, easy, moderate, high, etc. But I will say what's interesting is I had an experience where I wrote an adventure called Dungeon of Doom that's available free. And when we wrote it, working with the Dwarven Forge folks, I suggested to them, hey, you know, just so like you have a wide audience, why don't we write it for a really wide band of levels, like 1 to 10? And each room will have sort of tiering, tier 1, tier 2, tier 3 kind of thing. So we had slashes to everything, right? So like it would be, you know, the lock is DC X, Y, and Z. And people reacted to that really strongly, that there wasn't one true real world CR to it or DC to it. And we also had monsters, but it was particularly the DCs on skill checks that really made people go like, you know, this shouldn't tier up with characters, right? Like, why is climbing a rope getting harder or jumping over a pit harder or whatever? And it was like, well, the truth is adventurers do that all the time. You just didn't notice it until I did this, right? And that was the real reaction, right? It is interesting that people sort of don't like, a lot of people, not everybody, a lot of people don't like the idea that the world is leveled to the characters, but it kind of always is. Like you look at any adventure and you'll find these DCs will be way higher in high tier adventures than they will in lower ones. And why? Is it harder to, is the masquerade ball like an epic masquerade ball? Yes and no, right?
I actually just did something similar for a community game where we had a bunch of different tiers of D&D players because we're all in different bands. So I'm like level 4 to 8. My friend is 1 to 3, so on and so forth. And we were coming together to create a one shot for everyone. So I was like, okay, they're in a magic storm. It targets those who are the strongest first and saps more of their energy, which is why they had higher DCs. It's harder for them to do things because it's taking more energy out of them. And that was kind of our explanation to everyone why they were in like the same space and things were harder for their level 15 friends as opposed to level 5 friends. And so thinking about things like that, and as I think Chris and Teo said earlier, connecting it back to your world would be really helpful.
Making it live in the world. It is an interesting thing of like the tier. I feel like that's a thing right out of video games, though. Like if you've played JRPGs, or that's the main one I'm thinking of. But if you've played those, yeah, your skill difficulty scales with what your level is just to keep the game interesting. It is fun sometimes to have a bunch of difficulties that are extremely low for a group of high level characters. And they're just like, well, why are we even doing anything? And it's like, yeah, why? That's a good point. Why?
You could fail, so.
Yeah. like you still are all that one.
So two things. One, the giving the squash match essentially to your higher level party. I had it when I was running fourth edition for a long time, long running campaign. We've been playing for like, you know, a year and a half, pretty much weekly. They're pretty high level. They've been complaining for like 6 months that I would never give them a lower level encounter. And so finally I gave them one. They squashed it. Like, that was boring. I'm like, I don't know. What do you want? Like, that's, you've been asking me for this for months. The other one is Teos. I'm actually a little surprised that people reacted that strongly to that, because I mean, in Adventurers League, we used to have to write for multiple tiers at the same time.
Right.
It's weird that that wasn't like an accepted thing. So that was if I remember correctly, that Dungeons of Doom thing from the Dwarven Forge was a fifth edition adventure, right?
Yeah. And it's a big, big meaty adventure, but it was things like a door, you know, having a lock that the lock DC scaled, right? They would just, a number of people remarked, and particularly Mike Shea brought this up a lot from Sly Flourish, this idea of like, you know, why isn't the lock just a lock? And what I was trying to say to folks is it is, but if you look at, you know, just look at like the DCs that are in all these published adventures, and they change depending on the, you know, the actual level. You just don't think about it. It just feels right. But the idea is, yeah, if it's boring, right? If it's a DC 10 lock or DC 5 and you're really skilled, then, you know, that doesn't feel great, right? You roll really terribly. No, it opens. You're like, what? Oh, well, you know, why did I bother taking expertise in this then, right? And especially third edition, right? Third edition was things where you could hit DC 40 and things like that, right? I had a ranger that had this unbelievable track check, and a friend of mine put in a DC 50 in an adventure to see if I could hit it, you know? It was that kind of thing, an organized play.
It's so good.
And I'm like, yeah, of course I hit it, right? With all these bonuses and rolling high. And so then he could tell me that, you know, this particular little obscure detail about the thing and make me laugh. But that's the whole, you know, otherwise, why was my character doing all this? Why was investing all these skill ranks, right? And so particularly for some systems, you do want to have these. The point is a part of the interaction is responding to this challenge and being able to meet it. But the D20 is swingy, right? It depends on the system, sort of how you're going to see that or feel that. I'm aware of what character level people are, and I like the world just to tier up to the characters, essentially. I think people do it more than they're aware of, but it's probably the more unpopular of the two statements, right? And fifth edition is a little, at least it says that a lock is 15. Oh, but you can change it, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas fourth edition said the lock scales, right? It's or just skill checks in general will scale because it's based on your tier and here's the math of it, right? And other earlier games didn't even think about it necessarily, but third and fourth really were about scaling and up to the party.
So. I mean, it's so hard when you have 20 to 30 levels.
Yeah.
It's just a lot. It's a lot to cover, right?
Yeah. I think, though, like one of the things I like to do is I'll have the difficulty and then every five, this is D&D specifically, but every five or so that you're over that, there's a little like something extra, depending on what it is. Yeah. I do that a lot with encounters, but I also, I'm a big, big fan of, especially with social encounters, all of those being opposed roles. And so now you've got NPCs that are like scaling with it. But the third thing I'm going to throw in there is I do love the explanation of the force in the universe that's like, no, I'm making this harder for you.
Yeah.
It's like the god of low level characters is like, no.
Yeah. The powerful villains are employing the most skilled lockmakers and trap smiths and whatever is that, you know. Nobody else can access. Sure.
And I mean, I also think that's all your GMs as well. If you are seeing these scalings, maybe it's a level 20 DC lock for your level 15 characters. Why? What about this lock? Describe it to us. Like that's, even when you have modules, I think there's still like some things you can add in there at like for your own table, be creative with it and things like that. I did also want to touch on with this question. I know we've been here for a while, but we talked a lot about Dungeons and Dragons. What about systems like Powered by the Apocalypse, where you might not have a changing challenge rating or a skill check, but you're falling into these really hard lines of 6 and below, you fail, 7 plus, you succeed, and it tells you in the system what those look like. I know I'm a big fan of Powered by the Apocalypse, but I ask.
Me too.
Me three.
Here's a fun fact. Chris's old podcast introduced me to Powered by the Apocalypse.
Wow, and that's wild.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm old.
Yeah, shoot, please.
No, I'm old. I've just been doing this for a long time. That's all.
Just lamenting.
Yeah. Go ahead. You keep going.
For me, it's a lot of vibes. And encounters in there get to be a little bit more narrative. So you're kind of relying more on the dice themselves to kind of tell part of that story. If it is a fail, or if it is a failure on the dice, then, you know, what's that look like with Are they going to miss this clue? Or is it going to be that something happens that is not involved with that? And I honestly, like, I kind of think when I'm doing encounters with those games, I'm basically saying, well, here is the encounter. Let's see what happens. And that's really, really it. I have a Monster of the Week game that takes place in Sharn, and it's in this neighborhood that is has all these weird, like, time distortions and everything. And then I've been playing through with that group. That group has not actually done combat with any villain. They've defeated every villain through social means and finding a way to get to turn them into allies. They've done that the entire campaign. It's almost over.
That's what my kids do every time I put a combat encounter in front of them.
And it's like I've built everything I built was a combat encounter. And that group just, didn't do that, which has been amazing. And I think that's how I approach that kind of thing. I've also done quite a bit of Savage Worlds because I like Savage Rifts a lot. But that's one where sometimes you just blow up the party. I mean, with Rifts, you're kind of supposed to do that once in a while. But
or the opposite. I mean, I ran what was supposed to be a super thrilling, super hard encounter, and it wasn't not hard, but there were like three enemies with flamethrowers. And every single one of them, they managed to shoot them and cause the flamethrower to explode on the person carrying it. And so it was just like, yeah, this could have been so much harder, right? Yeah. Still one person really, really took it. But
that's really cool, though.
Yeah, it's really cool. Yeah,
it's really cool. It's super cool. And so, yeah, no complaints, right? But Savage Worlds is a system where, like, it felt like the vast majority of things we were doing, there were no rules covering it, right? Like no applicable skills. You're just doing it. And then at some point, everybody realizes, oh, there's actually a skill for that, right? There are very few skills. Like there are a lot of skills, but they're for really specific things versus the main things characters do. And then it's like presence checks all the time. And so it was very interesting because it was almost like when the rules would kick in, it would intrude.
Mm-hmm.
And you were better off without them because that's sort of what we ended up doing a lot of times, at least at our table. Other folks may have different experiences. In general, systems that have this kind of idea of a complication or an advantage, depending on how you roll, and Draw Steel kind of does that too, which is interesting because it's such a tactical mechanical game, but it still has that sort of idea. They can be tough on DMs, right? Because you have to sort of constantly be improvising and thinking. I remember watching someone who was running Edge of the Empire, the Star Wars role-playing game, where it has the dice that cause complications or advantages. And the DM was just so clearly struggling to come up with anything. And at some point, he just, threw his hands up and said, oh, okay, I don't know this game that well. Like, I'm running out of things. You get a plus one or what?
I think the thing I like to point to when we talk about this kind of thing that a lot of people didn't understand for a long time and still get wrong on the internet, because I've seen it pretty recently. I forget what podcast or YouTube video is the 12 hit point dragon from Dungeon World.
Mm.
So these games that are narrative that have the 6 -7 and 9 or whatever, success with a complication, failure, total success, and whatever, however you want to scale it. There's so much about narrative positioning that those pieces don't come into play without that. Like we were talking about the shooting of the flamethrower backpacks to make them blow up. That's a narrative positioning thing. Like we took aim, we shot backpack, we managed to hit it before we got burned to death. That meant that they blew up. They narratively positioned themselves, and then Teos used the rules to adjudicate it and made it happen. So like the dragon, like I go up and hit it with my sword. I'm like, well, you can't roll hack and slash. Like, why not? Because you have a sword and it's an ancient red dragon. It just bounces off of its scales. Go get something that's stronger than that. Now, right? Like you could have like, there's a move where you can get a sense of what's going on. You could have done that, right? Like I'm gonna take a second to assess. And then you can ask the questions like, what is dangerous here? Or what hidden secret lies below the surface? I'm like, oh yeah, look, he's missing a scale on the bottom of his belly and you can see it. All right. Yeah. Like I'm just to pull the example out that everybody knows from The Hobbit, but that's the kind of stuff when you're building out moments like that for games that have that kind of narrative flow to them, where there's not like a mini game for combat. D&D's got a mini game for combat. Pathfinder's got a mini game for combat. Yeah. They don't just like roll back and forth. I mean, even does Daggerheart have a mini game for combat? Kinda.
Yeah, but that is one where you could say hope or fear cause something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's where I'm at on that, Liz. Like, when people understand the concept of narrow positioning, then a miss, because it's not a failure, it's a miss in those games.
Yeah.
Matters a lot more, because how the miss is interpreted, and there's usually a giant choice list for the game master. The game's all about narrative control too, like who gets to choose what happens and how. That's all. Good. Cool.
What's your method for tailoring encounters to different play styles? So not so much the source material, the game itself, but to the players who are going to sit in front of you at the table.
When I'm looking at my players, I'm trying to think about the types of games that they like, the types of experiences they want, and that's going to tailor the encounters that I design for them, or how I take something that somebody else created and change it up for them. You know, Savage Worlds is a good example where, as we started playing the campaign, they clearly had a way they wanted to operate around things. And so the world would, you know, elements of the world would show up for them to do their shenanigans, because it was so clear that this is what they were, you know, they were going to do these kinds of ridiculous things. And that was the fun we were all having. And so it was very different than what the encounters were as written. The structure, I would take the concept of it, but then what the NPCs did, how they reacted, the opportunities they presented were all tailored to them in a very open type of play. In something more closed, like, you know, D&D, where it's got, you know, rooms and expectations for each scene, I will try to offer then additional opportunities on top of those. And I'll try to reinforce whatever else is going on the campaign, depending on the type of campaign, right? Maybe they are trying to build a castle. And so, you know, this is where you have that clue of how they talk to somebody who's known for stonework, or, you know, an agreement with the dwarves or something like that. You want to give them those kinds of clues that make them really excited about the things they care about in the game and add those into the encounters.
Yeah, that.
So when we're talking about play styles, we're talking about like OSRE type stuff versus like more narrative type flow stuff versus more trad type stuff? Or are we talking about something else?
I think we're just talking specifically about like who the players are, how the players approach.
Then I say what Teo said.
Yeah. I mean, that's really
it's a very comprehensive answer.
But it is funny if you have like, I don't know, I ran Shadow Dark for my players and, I killed them a lot. And a lot and a lot and a lot. I think we went through like 13 characters and it was a gauntlet, but it became like sort of way too much. And I could see they were not happy. And so I said, well, let's level up to, you know, from level 0 to level 1. And I still killed them a fair bit. And now they don't want to play Shadow Dark with me, which is too bad because I really want to play more. But that's one of those examples of where I kind of wanted to get, you know, really know the system. Well, I learned some things about the system, right? And were I to do it again, I would have to, you know, explain to them that I really am going to do it a different way so that it's not that same experience that we had.
I love that.
The one thing I will throw out there for this is that you can tailor to play styles in ways that make your overall story cook a little bit better. And with that one group that I mentioned that befriends everybody, I kept on adding the next encounter was less likely to be friends with them than the one before that. Like I would, you know, I kept escalating the anger level of the bad guys until now, when they're actually in the process of facing the like final boss, he's mostly angry about the fact that they wouldn't fight people. And and so there's really no getting around that one.
His work versus hemorrhaging because they keep making friends.
You know, his plan was actually relying on people to getting in fights and
actually doing the thing.
Yeah. And they didn't do that. They made a community, and that's like kind of a like beautiful, beautiful way to fight a bad guy. I think you could do that where you can just say, oh, okay, well, if you're not going to fight these things, or if you are going to fight everything, then this social encounter, I do not expect these characters to make it.
Yeah. It's really about like, for your players knowing what they want to do at the end of the day. And so, not to go back to DMing with kids, but it's a lot of what I do. I have chaos goblins who I know would love to see an NPC. They're going to kill that NPC immediately. And so knowing and being prepared for that to be a combat encounter and not structuring like a social encounter. I have some kids who they love, love, love a riddle roleplay kind of encounter. I don't build as many combat encounters for them. Or if I do, I build like multiple outlets in it for them, so they could take it in a more role play way. they could take it as like a skill challenge way. We can kind of pivot to what they're feeling for that day. But understanding what your players want to get out of the game is really important.
So I think I know why I'm having a bit of a difficult time thinking about these. I was thinking about this stuff all day and all day yesterday too. But I don't build encounters all the time anymore for my games because I'm building out the like these larger situations that are more open-ended. Mm. And I'm running a lot of heists and investigations, which means they can go kind of where they want to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm inventing stuff a lot of the time on the fly. Mm. I'm inventing encounters and situations or scenes on the fly. So when it comes to that for playstyle, like it's more about what the group, like what is the session zero stuff that we talked about? What are my stars and wishes that I'm doing all the time in putting forth towards me so that I can put those things in the game? Like my Friday night Rapscallion game, they like doing voices. They like being silly. We're a bunch of theater kids essentially playing a theater style game, and they wanted it to be comedic in a lot of ways. So I'm making up satirized situations all the time too, for mm-hmm. them to play off of. So all my NPCs and all my situations are based in and around that. And sometimes they're weird and sometimes they're scary, but mostly it's that. I mean, there's a Disney cruise ship that had, think of mixing Disney cruise ship with Ash versus the Evil Dead. It's a post-apocalyptic water worldy type thing, mm-hmm. right? So like there's a Minnie Mouse carrying a Mickey Mouse head in a bucket that's like, please help me. Oh my God. It's ridiculous, right? That's what they want, yeah. right? Like, yeah. That's what they're there for. My Delta Green game, on the other hand, is not that. Like I'm doing my best to make them feel like they don't understand what's going on, mm-hmm. because that's one of the primary things about Delta Green is you can't understand a lot of the stuff that is happening. You just have to kind of survive it, deal with it, and maybe save the world. So I'm building out situations like that. Like they were out of time, like a year in the past. So and they were hiding out so that Delta Green didn't come and take them out. Because when you are not on the mission and you mess up, sometimes you become the mission. That's a thing in Delta Green.
Uh-huh.
They were hiding out in a town in the Catskills, and gray aliens started showing up and abducting people because gray aliens are, strangely enough, in Delta Green. They work for the Mego.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that they abducted people is they would time stop the world, grab people, do whatever they're going to do to them, and put them back. Mm-hmm. Now, because they had been out of time, they weren't affected by the time stop. So then they could see what was happening. Now, they didn't understand everything that was going on all at once, but it scared them. They're like, this ain't right. Like at first their time was just being stopped, right? Like around them, but not them. So now they're weirded out about that. Then they're trying to figure out what's going on, and it's not okay for them. And somebody had already noped themselves out of the timeline by doing something they shouldn't have done. So, I mean, they knew that they could just die at any point in time, or at least be erased from existence. So that's the kind of stuff that I design. Like I designed a situation for them, not an encounter, but the whole like dealing with the time stop. And that was fun, because they figured out that if they touched stuff, it would go back into time for a hot second until they let go of it. But it was weird to them.
Feels a little bit like a macro encounter, though. Like your plot is the encounter.
Yeah, situation design versus
yeah.
I call it situation. Jason like Pitt coined the idea of situation, I think, and that's what I like to refer to it as. But then if you understand that and you understand some of those parameters, you can. If you want to, you can invent stuff. It's a little harder in certain situations when you need stat blocks and whatnot. But if you don't need as much of that stuff, or you have templates, then you can do a lot of that stuff.
Mm-hmm. And isn't every stat block just a template?
Everything's bears.
Yep. Everything's bears.
I had a lot of fun with that mix of totally open, random, and fixed, right? Like I was recently in a pirate Borg campaign, and our DM Jeff Muller would just roll for just about everything other than like small planned sequences. Like there'd be a dungeon, right? When we decide to go into that sea cave or whatever, well, okay, the sea cave might play out. But a shockingly large amount of every session was just he's rolling on those tables that the game provides. And he told us that up front. And so it was fun. You know, sometimes we're just looking at him as he's trying to process on the fly of what's going to happen. But it was always fun, always engaging. And it was really interesting to see things like, you know, we had a big ship battle and it went really well for us. And we're like, cool, let's just go to port. And he's like, well, I got to do one more check. Oh. And so then he describes, you know, I'm the captain. I get woken up and I look out at night across the ship to what, you know, one of the guys on the deck is pointing at, and I see another ship going by. So I said, you know, I'll get the spyglass and I look, and it's a crew of monkeys.
Yes. It's amazing.
Right?
Amazing.
It's all monkeys. Amazing. And I'm like, so well, good. I could let this go by, but I can't. And so I sent, you know, familiar type creature to go talk to them, and then ended up being war, and we got our butts handed to us, and it was just all random, right? It's just the way the thing all played out. But eventually we managed a truce with the monkeys, and the monkeys became a huge part of the campaign. And we're making banana rum for them, and, you know, just endless things going on. And there's an NPC who's afraid of the monkeys, and it's all just Jeff running off of these random tables, right? But it's surprisingly fun, right? It's just some campaigns that is absolutely the way to do it. It's super fun.
Well, so there was a mention of the pivot, and that brings us to the next question, which I think will be our last question. How do you pivot or adjust mid-session if an encounter is too easy, too hard, not engaging for a group? And Chris, in your with your situation, what if the situation is not going well? Like, what if they're not going towards the resolution of the situation?
I mean, then they lose. But I make that apparent, right? Like, they know that there's stakes. I have timers running on most of these things. So, the players always know that there's some sort of timer running in the background on all these things, and their characters can feel it by the events that are occurring. And in fact, it just happened in the Delta Green game that I was playing, that thing with the gray aliens, they were trying to, depending on the game, I don't change anything, right? Like, I just let them lose because they know that it's a possibility. It creates a culture at the table, right? Like, they understand what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
No, man, if an encounter's too easy, there's like all sorts of things that you can do. I ran tons of D&D, and it's not like been that long since I've done it. I'm going to do it again pretty soon because it's a fun game. I have this rule, like, at turn three, sometime during the third round, if something's got to change, because I'm bored otherwise, and I think the players get bored. So that's when I can decide, like, is this too easy or is it too hard? And then I will either add a thing that helps the players or add a thing that hurts the players, right? Like, any of those things could happen. And there's, like, depending on what the situation is, obviously, depending on what the encounter is and what's going on, there's any number of things that could happen. Like, that's just the template that I use for it.
Mm-hmm.
It's always, I mean, if you play enough games with me, it's always going to be turn three, maybe turn two, maybe one of those rounds, because it just always feels right. Because most D&D encounters don't last more than five anyway. If they do, it's usually a huge fight, and then you need to make sure that something changes round five too.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of helps them get their bearings too. Like, you can see how they're doing and then reassess.
Yeah,
it's a good number.
That's me. That's what I do.
I do kind of like the rule of, like, make sure you change something every odd numbered round of combat. So in round 93 of the same combat,
if something's gone terribly wrong in your game,
you will find me out the door by round 10. I think that's
is that like session one. Like session 13 of that fight, maybe 15.
That's like an episode of One Piece. Like, it's an anime battle at point in time. You've gone on for like 10 episodes. It's not over yet.
Oh man,
yeah.
I'm curious to hear what Teo has to say about this myself.
I really look at the players, right? Like, sometimes, you know, they're just destroying what you thought was going to be the coolest challenge, and they're happy as can be. Mm-hmm. Well, all right, you know, we're going to ride that on, and we're going to end early, you know, because that was awesome. Good job. Pat yourselves in the back. You know, I didn't expect it. You good job, right? And other times it's really brutal, but they are so into trying to find the way to eke out a victory that, you know, you don't want to make it any easier because they really want to earn it. And so great, you know, and so I try to get that read, especially when I'm running like convention games, right? You know, how does everybody feel about this? Is this good? Then, you know, that tells me whether I want to adjust something or not, because at the end of the day, I do see myself as a sort of showrunner in a lot of ways as DM. Not everybody does. That's totally fine. But I see myself as sort of like, I've got a role here. I'm having fun for sure, you know, so I want to have my fun, but I'm here to facilitate a fun time for you. And if changing it will create fun, then I'll do that, right? Some games it's easier to do like what you're talking about, Chris, where it's like you can just say, like, well, you know, you're gonna get so spanked that you gotta go off and deal with the repercussions. Something like Delta Green, that sounds great for that. But other times, you know, you wanna keep it within some sort of parameters, and I'm glad to make those adjustments. There's nothing too sacred for me to change up. And it helps when you think about, at least for combat encounters and role-playing as well, you know the motivations of these creatures and be communicating those so that players, because what players in most games don't allow them to do is run away. Most games are just terrible. You know, something will happen in initiative And that one person that everybody expected would run decides to fight one more round, and now they're down, and then nobody can run. And, you know, just it never works. And so fleeing is not an option. You need another type of resolution, either to hand wave and say everybody agrees to flee, or something else. And the something else is often because there is some motivation to these creatures. And it's apparent enough because of the way you've structured the encounter that now you can just give a small reminder like, well, remember, these are bandits. Mm-hmm. And then they'll go, yeah, okay, you know, hey, bandit friends, how about we talk about this? Mm-hmm. You know, we know something, you know, and then you get those kinds of ways that out of a trouble, you know, bad situation, if that's more fun than just adjusting the numbers a bit.
Yeah, the obvious GM hint. Hey, by the way, this is a, you know, hey, there's some loose rocks up there, you know, that kind of mm-hmm. thing. Like,
yeah, yeah.
I was of the, this is on your character sheet. Like, if only someone had a big sword.
Yeah. That explosive that you've been carrying around for, you know, 9 levels, you know, this is where you could use it.
What if it's just kind of, there's also part of this is not engaging, like it, like if they're not into it or bored.
I am the GM who, if I see, especially in like a social role play, like encounter, if they're not engaging already, we go into the next thing. Like we're moving mm-hmm. on. I had an NPC the party was not vibing with in one of my last sessions. And I went, okay, they can tell that you don't like them. They don't particularly like you either. They're heading on their own side quest. Like they're gone. They out of here. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like mm-hmm. you move on. And so I think sometimes there is like a, sometimes you got to fold. Sometimes you got to get creative with it and really think about like what your players are enjoying in this counter, what they're not enjoying. If it's a combat that's going on for too long, maybe you need to like change it up. Like Chris is saying, you know, mm-hmm. on each of those rounds, or maybe it's that, okay, they're not enjoying it. The monsters are still here. Maybe the monsters are going to start to flee now or start to do something crazy. To change up what this encounter looks like. It's a lot of that pivoting, which I guess is the question.
I had one where we're in Dark Sun where I thought it was going to be really fun. It was like a bunch of like small, you know, four-legged type dog-like Athasian creatures that were running around. I thought it was going to be a lot of fun. And they're just spanking these things. And so I had an alternate encounter I thought about that I didn't use. So I just grabbed it. And it was like a sort of bowl like of dirt around the area that they were fighting in. And so coming up over the edge, I put this huge dragon miniature and it just eats one of the things they've been fighting. Right. Just in a single gulp.
So good.
And it's like they all just sat up and took notice. Right. Yeah. Like the players were all like, oh, we're awake now. This looks fun. And that was such a great way to, you know, just escalate it by adding this new creature.
I like a little bowl of cereal just comes, picks up its little dog.
Yep.
Yeah.
No problems here.
There's always like a hard thing about giving advice about tabletop role-playing games. And that's why stories are so important about them is because they often lack context. Like we can, my thing about round three, change something. It's a template, right? Like if it's like what Teo said is awesome too. I've done it a ton of times where like, you just let it play out. If they're crushing it, let it play out. Like mm-hmm. me, like if they're getting crushed, sometimes I just let it play out. It just depends on the kind of game. It's like the Shadow Dark thing. They died a ton of times. Like that's what that game does.
Mm-hmm.
And the context of it was that's what that game does. So it's so tricky sometimes. But if we're talking about D&D, I think we hit all the high points of the things that the tools that you can utilize at least.
I was going to say, I actually have had times where like players were bored with an encounter that I knew still had some time left. And I was just like, oh, and rocks fall on the monsters. And like there, but I like the dragon, like something bigger coming. Yeah. And that's even better than that.
And that dragon thing's so good.
You all reminded me of a time I was running Blade Runner and the Blade Runner RPG is a lot of fun, but it has essentially the crit tables from Alien. And the thing is, those are two very different movies.
Yeah.
Yes. And they shouldn't have, in my opinion, who am I? But in my opinion, that is the biggest problem I have with the Blade Runner game. And so like we were having a fight with a bunch of, you know, just they're just dudes. And, you know, the bunch of guys with baseball bats and whatevers. And so they roll in and one of them crits one of the characters. And I decided to use the I think the bludgeoning table, even though this guy I think was holding a dagger, so technically it's piercing. And so the critical hit was a broken arm. And I was like, oh, well, I wonder what it would have been if I had gotten the same thing I rolled, but with a dagger. And it's punctured brain, immediate death. And I'm like, oh, wow.
No, too much.
So I'm like, no Blade chill. Runner is a game where you question your humanity and yeah. over time are making big changes to your character and how you see the world. And I'm like, and it would have just ended immediately. And then we played another combat and it was like the equivalent of a SEAL team dropped on the characters. And again, the crit was like, in fact, this one did happen. It sent them to the hospital for like 3 weeks and they were like a hacker type. So they could still do things, but they were now doing it all remotely.
Mm.
And I thought, you know, and so for the next session, I showed up with a revised crit table because I'm like, and I changed how long it took them to recover. Cause I'm like, I just don't think that's fun. You know, like I don't, I we're having fun with the big weighty decisions we're making and we don't need to be like permanently removed in this fashion. It's not that death can never happen, but it was a little much.
So, sometimes when an encounter isn't going the way you expect it, you need to change the rules that you didn't notice yep. in the game at first.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. I do that all the time. A lot of tables.
Yeah.
As I've heard Teo say many times, game design's hard. Sometimes yeah. you just don't get it right. Like, it's okay. We can fix it.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think that's a good advice for anybody out there who is like actually like looking for advice. You bought the game, like you can make adjustments if you need to. Every game.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even I think I told my players, like, you know, so I'm gonna use this new variant and if it doesn't work, we'll change it further. So mm-hmm. let's just play with it, right? Because I think this is what we want, and they all agreed. And it's like, okay, cool. And just sometimes it's okay to tear down that wall and say, look, this is a game with rules in addition to the narrative, and we're going to get this right so that it's fun for all of us.
Awesome.
This is Peer Review, where we are nerds who talk about nerds who are doing research on nerd stuff. And today, I'm so sad, but so excited to talk to you about an article that I was not able to read the entirety of. We're going to talk about the abstract of it, though. It has a great name. It is called When Does a Paperclip Become a Sundial? Exploring the Progression of Originality in the Alternative Uses Test by Dr. Kudrowitz and Dr. Depo. I think Depo. I know she was a student of his. Also, Dr. Kudrowitz, I emailed you. I hope one day you see my email and you send me this article because I'd love to read all of it.
Definitely listening.
Maybe you manifest what you want to see in the world, Doc.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Let's talk about divergent thinking, though, because this is what the alternative uses test is about. Divergent thinking is our ability, our cognitive process, to find multiple solutions to open-ended tasks. It's an idea of around creativity. This comes up a lot in encounter building, and not just as GMs who are creating encounters, but how our players are going to deal with those encounters, which we touched on today, whether it's a combat encounter they decide to role play and become friends with the bad guys with, or whether it's a combat encounter or encounter they're spanking and you have to find your own separate way to do something with that. The alternative uses test is a measurement of divergent thinking where you take an everyday ordinary object and you say, how many alternative uses do you have for this thing? So this article, which one day I'll read in full, manifesting once more for myself, gave almost like 300 participants a paperclip and went, what are the alternative uses you have for that? And then a short time frame, I think it was about 3 minutes. They found that on average, people could come up with about 9 alternative uses for a paperclip other than holding paper together. And also they found some variations within that. So there were some people who did not reach that average of 9 responses. And in those 9 responses, they were less likely to have highly original responses. Now, how highly original is defined, I don't know. I only have the abstract. I want more of it. Oh my goodness, I love this part better. But those who had more elaborate responses generally came up with less responses overall, and therefore less highly original responses. And so this was really testing about how this test, this paperclip test, demonstrates creative thinking, divergent thinking amongst human beings. And so I had a question for our group here today, thinking about alternative uses and everyday objects, and something we haven't really talked about in our podcast so far is, like, how do you take everyday inspiration into account when you plan encounters? I know I've done this where I'm drinking a cup of coffee, and I'm like, huh, how could I include this into my game? But also, how do you plan for that for your players as well? And that idea of divergent thinking.
I put a lot of things in my encounters, partly because I like have a complex mindset. And so I think a lot of, you know, I can't stop. I can't turn it off when I really should. So I put a lot of things in there, and in part because I don't know which way they'll go. And I like to think of it as sort of like potential energy in an encounter, right? Things that could happen. Maybe they'll use this ladder. Maybe they'll use the, you know, powder keg. Maybe they'll use the, and they might not, but having that, right? And so like that encounter with the flamethrowers in Savage Worlds was, you know, a bridge over a gorge, that the bridge was partly open and there were rocks on both sides and a river. And I didn't know where they would go, what they would use, but I was prepared to kind of play with that depending on what they came up with. And so as they did things, you know, I just made rulings and calls. And sometimes in a room, they'll use very little. But if something like that, like I like the idea that this study was saying 1 out of 9, because when you have 6 players, well, that's a pretty good chance that somebody then will come up with something original and interesting and surprising. So the more little bits you have to mess with, the more that can happen, right? Whereas if you have a room that just has 4 goblins in it, there's very little that can happen with it. But you put a goblin flinger in there, you know, catapult, goblin catapult, now things can happen, right?
I mean, I'm just imagining the like the orc caves where every room is just has a balcony and a chandelier that you can swing from if you need to, just in case.
Yeah.
So themes of gameplay and everyday inspiration. I mean, I've been working on a game for 3 years that's all about classism in a city. So, you know, I mean, that there's nothing real about that in the world.
Oh, no.
The encounters that I design have nothing to do with that. They have everything to do with that. And I watch a lot of anime. I really do. I have a Crunchyroll subscription. I watch tons of it. And I watch a lot of TV in my spare time, listen to a lot of podcasts when I'm not doing this other stuff, which has been less lately for the watching TV and podcasts and whatnot. But that stuff all finds it into my games because my players don't watch the same things that I do. I mean, some of them do now, though, so I have to like find other sources of inspiration because I can't just utilize those things without feeling like they're like, oh yeah, you got that from there. I'm like, yeah, I did. That's fair, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But everything I do, everything any of us do, is just about taking the stuff that we enjoy or observe in real life and putting it into our art. When I went to school for literature, I think I have a degree in creative writing. That's not a big deal. But like one of the things I learned is like, just observe the world and then put it in your art. Like that's what we're trained to do. I don't know. That's every day.
Playing conventions helps, right? Can I just add, you made me think about behind me, there's the Lego D&D set, and I played a game using Toon and the D&D Lego set at Gamehole Con. It was amazing. And just the creativity of that DM gave me so many ideas, right? Yeah. So just like you said, exposing yourself to various different ideas and stuff is just, you soak it all in. It's great.
Yeah, man. You want to be a better game master? Go watch and play with other game masters. This is one of the best ways to get better at the craft. It really is. Aside from running games, you do those two things.
Those are the two things that I do have a, which I haven't added to in a long time, but I do have like a set of pictures on my phone that are cool set pieces. I run a lot of superhero stuff. And so like, what would this thing, you know, if I was going through a city, I'm like, oh, that's cool. I need a picture of that, and be able to look at that and go, yeah, like this is, oh yeah, this, they're going to show up on this weird ledge thing, or, you know, this big statue is going to somehow affect this scene. And I think that's something that I'd never really thought about in that way, I guess, but that's exactly what that is. I also think that the other thing I do is that, players will come to you with weird ideas. Kids in D&D.
Yeah.
Hey, I have create destroy water, and those weird fish creatures are driving around in a bathosphere. I ran a game called Dungeons and Drag Racers for a little while, and these weird fish creatures are in a bathosphere, and can I destroy all the water in there? And I'm like,
yeah.
Why, yes, you can.
Yep, you can. You're gonna beat that racer.
when we're talking about divergent thinking with kids, they come up with the craziest solutions to things. I do want us to talk, if we have time for table that, talk more about those. But I will put like the most normal encounter, just like you are sitting in an inn having breakfast, and they will find a way to make it the wackiest time. The wackiest time.
I keep in mind a Ak Inc. episode that they did during Storm King's Thunder, where during this game, Jim Dark Magic's player, he is grabbed by a giant griffin and hoisted off the top of this tower. And most players would go like, oh no, you know, I'm in real trouble. And they would start thinking of the typical mechanics of D&D to, you know, combat mechanics to escape the situation. Comes to his turn and Chris Perkins says, all right, what do you do? And he says, well, you know, I'm just going to look up at this majestic griffin and I'm going to just going to stroke its cheek. and he's like, you know, Chris Perkins is like, okay, you know, make me a, you know, persuasion check or whatever it was that he had him do. And he rolls something really high and he's like, you now have a griffin. Where do you want to go?
Yeah.
You know, like just so perfect, right? Just
beautiful.
Just great.
Teos, was that the one that they play, that they showed in the movie theater?
It was that same year.
It was that same
year.
Yeah,
yeah, that was the one in the movie theater. Yeah, you're right.
Did you write that adventure?
I didn't write I wrote one that they gave away at the
movie
theater.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Because I have it somewhere in my house.
Cloud Giant's Bargain. Yeah. Yeah. But that moment just stays with me, maybe because it was related to that project I did. But it's just, I just thought like that is such a perfect, you know, you have to have the player that's willing to think outside the box. Mm-hmm. And then the DM that goes, yeah, absolutely, right? And those are just priceless moments. When you both work towards them, they're just such great time, right?
I love that he like, it wasn't just a case of that person going, well, I'm going to try to befriend the creature. It was like, oh, look at this majestic, beautiful creature. You know what? Here, let me give you some scritches there. Here, buddy.
So good.
That's great. That's great. All right. We do got to move on to our final question. Chris, Teos, what is one thing you wish every player understood about how you're building encounters for your games?
That once the encounter starts, the design isn't done. Like, we're still designing mm-hmm. these encounters as we're playing them, which mm-hmm. means they'll shift and they'll change as we're going. No matter what we had written down beforehand, they're going to probably change. That's the one thing.
That's a good one.
I love that. Mine is just, especially from running convention play, there are times when people show up with their super optimized things that they want to do. Like in D&D, right? You know, I'm going to counterspell the spell. I'm going to take the biggest, most obviously dangerous thing in the room and I will banish it. I'm going to hypnotic pattern everything or attack them one by one. And whenever I see that, even as a player, I'm like, you just mathematically defanged that encounter so significantly that we're no longer experiencing it from a challenge perspective. And if the encounter doesn't have other fun things to do, now we're just like rolling some dice and carrying it out. But the conclusion is inevitable and to me no longer fun.
Yeah.
And I wish more players understood that encounters have a math to them in a lot of games. And when you do those kinds of things, maybe think before you do them, right? Because you change the experience. And I remember in particular in one encounter that I played, I was like, ooh, I've never fought a 5th edition Aboleth. And the player next to me goes, I banish it. And I'm like, before you do that, do we want to just see what it does? Nope. Okay. All right.
Very fair. It gets to that collaborative piece too, where I have players like that where they're highly optimized, but what does the table want to do? Maybe you want to see the Aboleth mm-hmm. for just like a few rounds and then banish it. I don't care, you know? What does the group want in that sense?
We can fight it a little bit, just see what it does. You know, like wait to see if we need to banish it.
It
like,
looks pretty
maybe
sick.
It's okay.
I just want to dip my toe in the Aboleth, that's all.
Yeah, because otherwise this encounter is about like three minor creatures that were with the Aboleth, and that's not even a fun encounter, right? It's like so there's some games that the math is so important to it. That it, you know, when you pull it out, you're really asking a lot of your DM to make it fun, because that was the fun. You just got rid of the fun. You just counterspelled the fun or hypnotic patterned it, whatever. And yeah.
Before we go, let's give our guests a moment to tell you where you can find them, starting with Chris.
So I have two new shows that you'll probably be able to watch when you get a hold of this. One of them is called Tabletop Treehouse. That is a YouTube and podcast GM advice show that I am doing these days. It comes out bi-weekly. And the other one is the Fail Forward Society, which Doc Jesse Edmund Palindrome is on that show too. Hello. There's a season called Scritches, which is if Zootopia 2 met Chinatown. And there will be a forthcoming, probably when this comes out, or it might be out, season of I Didn't Hear No Bell, which is our wrestling AP. That one will absolutely be on the YouTube too, because we're filming it in the studio that I'm sitting in right now.
Mm-hmm. Love it. You can find me at alphastream.org. From there, you can get to my videos. You can get to our podcast of Mastering Dungeons, all the other things that I'm involved in. They'll all be available through there. Thanks so much for having me on the show. It's been super fun. Great to talk to you again, Chris.
Yeah, you too, Taos. It's always I hear you so much, but I never get to talk to you.
It's great to see you at Gamehole Con every year.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for spending time with us on the Forever GMs podcast, both of you, and to our listeners for today. If you want to support the show, check out our Patreon for bonus content and behind-the-scenes goodness like Table That, which we'll record right after this session. You can also find us on TikTok and Blue Sky, and we're always looking for your ideas on what we should tackle next. Reach out on socials or email us at forevergms@docpalindrome.com. And remember, Forever GMs never stop leveling up the table. Bye-bye. Bye.